At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Raising Health, where we explore the real challenges and enormous opportunities facing entrepreneurs who are building the future of health. I'm Olivia.
And I'm Chris. Today's episode is with Philip Tagari, Chief Scientific Officer of Insitro. He is joined by Vijay Pandey, Founding General Partner at A16Z Bio and Health.
Together, they talk about the power of medications to change lives and alter history.
And it said, you know, this was the invention of MMB-693, and this was the drug that won the war. And I did some reading about that, and it turns out that, in fact, in December of 1943... when Britain was essentially almost on its knees, Winston Churchill was traveling back from the Middle East from a conference with President Roosevelt and contracted pneumonia. MMB-693 was airlifted to him by the Royal Air Force from the factory in Dagenham, and it saved his life and the lives of countless Allied soldiers since. And I thought, oh my God, a drug can genuinely make a difference.
And of course, they talk about how AI is permanently altering methods of drug discovery and development.
What we're in this transition from is from finding to designing, that we've amassed enough knowledge across these various modalities, various molecules, and can start to think, you know, much more about, okay, here's the biology we need to impact. Here's the therapeutic, how it needs to act. Here's the design that kind of gets you there.
You're listening to Raising Health from A16Z Bio and Health.
It's my distinct pleasure to have today Philip Tagari, CSO of Insitro, as our guest on Raising Health. Great to have you on the show, Phil.
And wonderful to be here. I'm very excited to talk.
We are too. And so you've spent decades in bio and pharma. How did it all start?
I knew that this is what I wanted to do very early on in my career. And that came through a kind of really interesting pivotal moment for me. I had finished high school and was set to study organic chemistry at Cambridge. And I did something that, you know, was comparatively common in the UK at that time, which was to take a gap year. And I was very fortunate to get a job. And on my very first day, you know, I came into the laboratory and there was a glass case that had a laboratory notebook in it. And it was opened at the page for the discovery and first description of a compound called sulfapyridine. And there was a little plaque next to the notebook and it said, you know, this was the invention of MMB-693. And this was the drug that won the war. And I did some reading about that. And it turns out that, in fact, in December of 1943, when Britain was essentially almost on its knees, Winston Churchill was traveling back from the Middle East from a conference with President Roosevelt and contracted pneumonia. And MMB-693 was airlifted to him by the Royal Air Force from the factory in Dagenham, and it saved his life and the lives of countless Allied soldiers since. And I thought, oh my God, a drug can genuinely make a difference. I'd always thought of medicines as things that made a difference to, you know, a few people here and there. And I think that was the point where I thought, wow, you know, this is an important enterprise. Discovering medicines that can make a real difference to hundreds or thousands of people and perhaps, you know, change the course of history. And I think from that day on, I've never wanted to do anything else. And still don't want to do anything else, which is, I think, one of the reasons that I'm so happy to be at Insitro today, where we are really kind of trying to do this in a really different way.
Well, that's kind of mind-blowing. Through the arc of your career, how have your interests changed and evolved? You know, you've seen a fair bit of changes of the industry.
you know, when I started in the industry, you know, at Merck in 1987, we were incredibly focused on chemistry to the extent that the, you know, people in the vaccine division, you know, who were incredibly accomplished protein scientists, were kind of regarded as the second class citizens of Merck, and chemistry was king, right? But very quickly it became apparent that, in fact, there was more to drug discovery than chemistry. And I think the realization that biologics were going to be an incredibly important part of drug discovery and new medicines that would make a difference was, I think, the first real change in the thing that I've been interested in. I was very fortunate when I was working at Oxford University to be in a collaboration with Cesar Milstein, where we actually made the first bispecific monoclonal antibody by, you know, fusion of hybridomas, so a hybrid-hybridoma. And when I was at Merck, I began to think, well, why couldn't we make antibody drugs as well as small molecules? And I was kind of severely beaten around the head and said, no, antibodies will never be drugs.
When they said antibodies would never be drugs?
That was in 1996. And that was actually what triggered my desire to leave Merck, which was at the height of its, you know, prowess as drug discovery company, and move to Amgen, where, you know, biologics were really being invented and industrialized. You know, I sometimes laugh to myself, you know, last year when I saw the, you know, the first IL-5 receptor antagonist approval, you know, a drug that was, you know, maybe 30 years late in coming.
You know, when people were talking about antibodies and never being drugs, it wasn't like they were completely wrong, that there are real reasons for why they may have concerns. And actually reminds me a lot of when I started in computational drug design, like now, like 25 years ago, people had some real concerns, but, you know, times changed there too. I'm curious, what were the winds of change that you're seeing that led you to go now not from Merck to Amgen, but from Amgen to Insitro?
In 2016, you know, in my former role at Amgen, we'd come to the end of what I would begin to call the long march of translational informatics, right? That we started in 98 when I joined the company with the goal of capturing all of the data that was generated by research at Amgen. So everything about every single molecule, clone, cell line, in a way that had rich metadata. And we'd done that, you know, and we were like, wow, we did that. And we were looking around saying, okay, what is the next thing? And we went through an exercise where we interacted with companies that were in the tech space with long product cycles. So companies like Schlumberger in oil exploration, Disney residuals, chip companies, and asked them, you know, what do you see as the next horizon? And they uniformly said machine learning, which was really, you know, in its infancy in drug discovery. And, you know, we began to do a lot of investigation there. We began to invest in machine learning. And it became very apparent in the 2016-2017 time period that this was going to be really quite transformative. In the same way as we embarked upon that long, you know, haul to capture data, we embarked upon the journey to, you know, really attempt to use machine learning and, you know, its more sophisticated forms to really make an impact on drug discovery. The challenge is, you know, that is hard to do in a big organization, and people are skeptical, you know, about technology that is perhaps less explainable than monoclonal antibody technology, is less accessible than traditional, you know, computational chemistry and physics-based methods. And so it really became quite challenging to make real traction. And so I began to think then about, you know, if you can't build it, can you go to where it, you know, legitimately exists? And that was the, I think, you know, spark that led me ultimately to Insitro.
History of disruption theory would suggest that the most transformative technologies are very difficult to build, you know, into existing organizations. What do you think makes AI or machine learning kind of in that category? Like, What is it that's different about it that you think makes it that much harder for incumbents to be able to build it in-house?
One of the main challenges, and this is something, you know, we think about it in Citro all the time, is explainability. The last 30 or 40 years of drug discovery, you know, has been this long transformation from really quite artisanal and serendipitous drug discovery to this kind of very rigorous, rational, and, you know, rational stepwise process. You know, if you think even 50 years ago, you know, you would extract things from plants and bacteria and soil samples and test them empirically. And that was how all antibiotics and the statins and, you know, numerous other, you know, incredibly important medicines were discovered. And so we went through this era of kind of hyper-rationality where everything has to be completely explainable, you know, down to the last kind of decimal place. And then, you know, machine learning is not like that. You know, machine learning is seeing patterns that human beings can't see. It's seeing structures in data that we haven't, you know, interpreted cognitively. And so it becomes really, you know, very challenging to deploy it in this hyper-rational environment. And it also, frankly, requires, you know, a skill set that is less transferable than many. If you look at most of the informatics departments in pharma, you know, they're often populated by people who aren't computer scientists by training. They're populated by people who are industry professionals who've learned, you know, a significant amount about information technology. Machine learning is not like that. You know, that you know, high-end machine learning, you need people who are highly trained and think very abstractly, and often they're not a good fit in the organization.
No, I think it's very well said. And I think it's the people challenges sometimes that become more significant than the technologies. How has it been like moving to a startup?
Well, I was very fortunate, you know, in my years at Amgen to be very closely involved in our corporate venture fund and spent a lot of time working with startups. I would say the downscaling aspect was kind of expected. You know, occasionally I wake up and say, oh yeah, you know, I need to find somebody to do that thing. And then it's like, oh shit, I am that person who has to do that thing. And so I got to do that thing. What I would say that I wouldn't say shocked, but was really, wow, you know, this is a thing, is the pace. You know, we try to operate at the pace of a tech company, not a biotech company. The speed by which products get produced, deployed, the speed at which we have to make decisions, the rate at which we're trying to do biology, this is really quite extraordinary and very differentiated from, you know, the bigger companies like Merck or Amgen. And then I would say the other thing is just the astonishing quality of the talent that small companies can attract.
Maybe we should step back and like talk a little bit about drug design, maybe before and after. I think especially some of our listeners will be coming from the AI side and maybe unfamiliar with the drug design side. You know, could you tell a little bit about what, like, for a typical therapeutic, what traditional drug design pathway would look like versus what the sort of this more modern machine learning version looks like? How do things change?
Yeah, so I always kind of characterize this change as moving from finding to designing. So, you know, up until probably even 10, 15 years ago, and maybe even more recently, you found most drugs. There's a reason that people are called drug hunters, right? You know, the drug is out there in the wild and you have to go and catch it. And, you know, that was true because, you know, at the beginning of the industry, most drugs actually were pre-existing. They were natural products, either from, you know, other organisms or proteins or hormones or metabolites that, you know, circulated within our own systems, okay? And so you actually kind of found those things. The whole class of GLP-1 agonists arose from peptide from the saliva of the Gila monster, right? And then the industry tried to pivot to being more rational, but it still always came back from this starting point of, you know, finding something, right? You found something from a high throughput screen, or you found something from a virtual physics-based screen, or you found an antibody through immunization of an animal and looking, you know, for millions of years of evolution to give you an answer. We found the T cell. What we're in this transition from is from finding to designing, okay? That we've amassed enough knowledge across these various modalities, various molecules, and can start to think, you know, much more about, okay, here's the biology that we need to impact. Here's the therapeutic, how it needs to act. Here's the design that kind of gets you there. I have a good friend who, you know, was in the space program and was constantly shocked by the fact that, you know, we would put drugs into the clinic and they would fail. And it's like, I would get fired if every time, you know, the rocket booster went off, you know, one out of five times it exploded. And that's an 80% success rate as opposed to the 20% success rate. So I think the ability to move away from, you know, this just empirical thing and, okay, here's now the thing that we need to design and here's the people we're going to design it from. That I think is the real transition that is occurring in the industry.
I love that analogy. You know, even in going to the moon, it wasn't Apollo 1 that went to the moon, it was Apollo 11. And even Apollo 1 was after Mercury and Gemini, and they've done all this stuff. But Apollo 1 to 11 is gradually building up, getting the Saturn V into orbit, doing some maneuvers, going to the moon, but not landing. And then finally, Apollo 11, you sort of incrementally engineer all this stuff, such that you build and learn, rather than just like trying something and see if it goes to the moon, trying something else and see if it goes to the moon. Well, one of the things when you're talking, I was thinking about is like there really maybe are really three phases of drug design that you could call out. One is the very old days, which were very phenotypic, you know, natural products maybe put into tissue, not rationalized at all, no molecular biology by any means. It was, you know, very macro. And then there was that rationalization where we moved from phenotypic. We wanted to understand the pathways and the proteins and the protein structure and how it's bound. And we brought in all that rationalization. And I think we got frustrated that all that information just proved how difficult biology is. But now we're in some sense with phenotypic screens and ML, where it's sort of maybe getting to the best of both worlds, where we have the detailed, rich information. But yet we start to sort of have this more systems holistic view of what these things are doing.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. You know, it was a wonderful time when we could clone and express and purify proteins and do biochemical assays. But it's very naive to think that proteins exist by themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, they constantly exist in complexes that change and are modified. You know, there's the whole new biology that's been appearing around condensates inside cells triggered by, you know, oligonucleotides. And so, you know, being able to capture that highly rational piece through a thread of genetics, which is the kind of digital part of the cell, you know, it really does give you that ground truth. But understand how, you know, molecules interact and create the biology that we see and that we need to impact. I think that is absolutely correct, that this idea that we can do systems biology discovery, you know, I think it's going to be really quite transformative, particularly for the more complex diseases, right? You know, lowering your blood pressure by dilating your arteries is a pretty straightforward thing. Curing Parkinson's disease, pretty not straightforward thing.
Yes, yes. I don't know if it's possible for you to talk about how machine learning is being done in Citro to change the process. I don't know if you could give any specific examples.
You know, we've able to create a semi-synthetic patient cohort through imputation across multiple modalities, so MRI, metabolites, biomarker, DEXA, which powered us enough to do genetic discovery for fatty liver disease in a way that is not confounded by obesity. So much fatty liver disease is driven by obesity. It's very hard to deconvolute it. You need, you know, pretty fancy functional MRI to do so. And then through using advanced clinical machine learning, we were able to create a data set that was large enough and powered enough to do genetics. And that, you know, gave us line of sight to a completely novel mechanism or completely unexplored mechanism in terms of the genesis of fatty liver disease. We were able then to, you know, look at the genes that were involved in those pathways using our pooled optical screening technology, which, you know, fundamentally cannot be performed without advanced machine vision and omics machine learning, able to recapitulate those phenotypes in hepatocytes in dishes. And, you know, we're then convinced enough to trigger 4 or 5 programs using siRNA modalities to get proof of principle in animals. And, you know, that was all done in a 12-month period, which kind of shows, you know, that machine learning is not only an enabler of new things. So, you know, we were able to discover genes because we, you know, were powered to do so through machine learning, but it's also a massive accelerator, okay, that's something that perhaps using traditional, you know, target discovery techniques might have taken 3 or 4 years, we can do in, you know, 10 or 12 months. For all of us at Insitro, it was like, wow, you know, this really works. And it becomes more the question then of how do you reload? How do you scale? How do you then start to make decisions when things are happening so rapidly?
Well, and especially that's a beautiful example, but almost like the density of concepts in your sentences were very high. And like we could sort of break it down, but it basically was not just a little bit of machine learning here or there. It was to some degree machine learning throughout in all the different aspects to deconvolute the biology, to understand the mechanism, and eventually to even sort of get you towards therapeutics, or in this case, maybe it was more straightforward given the approach. But it feels like it's not just something that you could sprinkle on top, but that's something that pervades the way you think about everything.
Yeah, no, I would say that, you know, coming back to the challenges of building, you know, machine learning in pharma, is that the systems are not native for machine learning. And once you start building from the ground up with machine learning in mind, you actually, you know, your architecture is very different. Your infrastructure is very different. The way you approach things are very different. And so things do go a lot faster. And you start to then get in this mindset of, well, can we improve this through machine learning? Can we improve that through machine learning? And you get in a virtuous cycle that you start to reuse your models, you start to reuse your infrastructure, and you generate the flywheel effect, which, you know, is an incredibly exciting place to be.
Where do you think the first big wins will come from? There's been a lot of talk about AI and drug design, but usually, you know, people ask, you know, where are the drugs? But of course, this whole cycle through clinical trials and so on takes many years. I'm curious, if you were to preview the future, where you think this approach will have the biggest immediate impacts?
Patient stratification, you know, it's one of the kind of dirty secrets of the therapeutics business that most patients get the wrong dose of the wrong drug at the wrong time, right? And, you know, it's almost a miracle that they get any benefit at all. And so I think, you know, just the ability to very rapidly and inexpensively, you know, and accurately stratify patients who are going to respond better to their medicines, to have the appropriate dose and the dose regime, that is a big win for the industry. It's a big win for society and healthcare systems, and it's a big win for patients. And so there's an enormous amount of interest in deploying machine learning tools. And I think that is a place where there'll be, you know, almost immediate benefit to society. And it's a place where I think Insitro wishes to participate. I would also say, you know, having spent, you know, so many years bringing, you know, fantastic molecules into the clinic that didn't do anything because we didn't understand the biology, that the real durable impact will be in target discovery. So to really understand, here's the 2 or 3 or 4 proteins, pathways, processes that really need to be modified to have an impact in a disease. And that hopefully, you know, we get that success rate up from the 20%, you know, to more like the 80%. And that is a huge win for everybody. It's a huge win for the industry. It's a huge win for medical systems and patients.
Well, yeah, I think in that first example of stratification, it kind of unravels or decouples some of the complexities of biology to create something where you would expect greater success because it's just cleaner. And it's not a mixture of different effects that can be confounding. It's something that's understandable by construction. And then the second one is another version of that. It sounds like that, again, it's sort of taming the complexity of biology, it feels like, to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think the next 5 years, next 10 years looks like in pharma?
I'm probably going to give you two answers, okay? I would say the first answer, you know, like many industries where there is fundamental overcapacity, there is going to be consolidation. It's kind of inevitable. You can't have, you know, 35 companies working on KRAS inhibitors, right? So I think there'll be consolidation. And I think there will be a ruthless drive for efficiency. And that drive for efficiency will have to include advanced machine learning, okay? You know, there's an enormous amount of waste in biomedical research. That waste, you know, raises the costs of medicines, it reduces accessibility, it has enormous environmental impact. And I think, you know, you'll see that the survivors will be extremely efficient enterprises that use machine learning and automation that will generate a kind of different medical ecosystem where personalized medicine is achievable, right? You know, we talk about personalized medicine and then look at the cost of it and it kind of goes away. And, you know, by being efficient, by being highly targeted, by using all of the tools of compute and automation, perhaps personalized medicine, you know, in a really efficient, consolidated way is doable. So that's kind of my somewhat heretical view of where things will go.
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, if you can stratify to a small cohort, it doesn't have to be a cohort of one, there may be 10,000 people like me in the world, but like maybe not a billion people like me, right? And certainly not seven. So it could become personalized pretty quickly, even just through extending some of the methods you already have described. But what's interesting about what you're describing now is you're describing not just a life sciences company that is developing drugs, or not just a life sciences company that would identify targets or hit those targets or bring those targets to trials through all of these methods, including patient stratification, but this comes into play afterwards too. You're now talking about care delivery to some degree as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think the industry has kind of flirted with care delivery, you know, for a number of years, you know, most recently with the managed pharmacy benefit, you know, consolidation and deconsolidation. The idea that you are delivering, you know, more than just a medicine, that you're delivering, you know, a health solution, I think is the place where most value is going to come, and rightly should come, right? Medicines bring enormous value, right? Almost disproportionate value. And so making sure that value gets realized, you know, and not diluted throughout a whole chain of bureaucracy and distribution and access, I think is where many companies are starting to think.
Yeah, and I think that's such an amazing world, because when we can finally stratify such that we can know who this drug works for, we can take a lot of the trial and error on the care delivery side out, and it becomes engineering there as well.
Yep.
So I'd love to just end with a few questions, sort of bigger picture things. Building a sort of a company with a tech mindset in life sciences is pretty new, right? I mean, I think there's some examples, but especially this interface where the way that Insitro is doing it is a relatively recent phenomenon. Any advice for people looking to build companies in this space? For especially how you manage these teams, presumably from the outside, it would seem like you could have two cultures that you have to blend. You have to blend the tech AI ML side and the life sciences side. How does that work?
That is so true. And it means you have to be bilingual. You know, I'm very fortunate that, you know, I spent some time in Quebec and I ran my lab in French. And you understand that you have to be able to speak both languages in order to be successful. And I think that's the number one thing I think anybody in this space needs to realize is you know, you can't just wear your machine learning hat, or you can't just wear your biologist hat. You really have to wear both of those hats. And a lot of it is very simple learning the language. You know, the words, you know, words mean different things in different disciplines. And so as much time as people can spend to be fluently bilingual, that is an enormous enabler of the kind of tech bio world. You know, the other thing is the tolerance of risk, you know, and the willingness to be wrong. Biologists, because they come up through this very academic, you know, somewhat competitive PhD postdoc system where, you know, being wrong in front of your peers is a terrible, terrible thing, right? Whereas writing some code that didn't work and then debugging it, it's perfectly natural, right? You know, and so this willingness to be wrong and to ask, you know, ask questions and get feedback is a very tech part of the culture, and takes a while for biologists, I think, to really absorb. But it's an incredibly important thing because that's how you go quickly.
Oh, that seems like a key secret to getting this done. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Raising Health.
Okay, thank you so much. Great to be here.
Thank you for listening to Raising Health. Raising Health is hosted and produced by me, Chris Chatiosian,
and me, Olivia Webb,
with the help of the Bio and Health team at A16Z. The show is edited by Phil Hegseth.
If you want to suggest topics for future shows, you can reach us at raisinghealth@a16z.com. Finally, please rate and subscribe to our show. The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. Please note that A16Z and its affiliates may maintain investments in the companies discussed in this podcast. For more details, including a link to our investments, please see a16z.com/disclosures.